Welcome to What's My Wine? This is a show where a group of friends explores wines from various regions throughout the world. Today we'll be exploring the Pinot Noirs from Willamette Valley, that's in Oregon. We've already done some tastings of wines in Italy and France, and it's nice to come back to the U.S. and look at some of the remarkable wines that are being produced. Our cadre of friends includes Joe Canini, Larry Burdick, Keith Zimmerman, myself, Cynthia Reeves. This is WOOL-FM 91.5 Bellows Falls. So let's start with just a little bit of background. This is a relatively new region. In other words, this is a region of winemaking that didn't even materialize, really, until like the mid-1900s?
Actually, it began with the Oregon Trail in the 1850s. Actually, that's when they first planted grapes in the Umpqua Valley.
Right.
Prohibition wiped out a lot of the...
Whatever had started.
And then it really didn't start again until...
The 1960s.
Yeah. In one essay that I was reading, they talked about two stages of westward expansion that had to do specifically with wine. One was that 1800s, the Oregon Trail, and then the next one was the 1960s, when there was a diaspora from Northern California as winemakers began to look for new and fertile grounds and untried areas to see if they could replicate some of the amazing French wines, and that's how the Pinot Noir, I think, that grape, came to be predominant there?
Yeah, prior to the 60s and prior to these, basically these great scientists graduating from UC Davis in California and looking to become bespoke winemakers in the European tradition, they thought for years, and their predecessors thought that it was too cool to grow Pinot Noir in the foggy, too many fungus problems. But it happens to like lie right on the 45th parallel. So that's usually magic for winemaking around the world.
And what is the region at the 45th parallel?
For example, in France.
Is that Burgundy? Yeah.
Yeah. And at the lower reaches, it would like be
Northern Rhone.
Yeah. Northern Rhone. So
lovely.
So, yeah. And so very expressive grapes can be grown in that area. And so the 60s started, as you said, the diaspora, and then they moved up and really dedicated themselves, and it was quite different because there was really nothing. A lot of hazelnut trees, a lot of great other agriculture in the Willamette Valley, but just some very early, Dick Etzel is one of them, pioneers that grew a few vines. And then they came.
I think David Lett was the first.
David Lett,
in 1965.
Yep.
So
yeah,
mid-60s is when he first planted the first Pinot Noir.
Yeah. So one of the questions that came up for me, there were so many winemakers that came from California, and then they were all relying back on UC Davis, I think, for their horticultural expertise. Yeah. And I'm wondering, did that influence or limit the way in which this grand experiment began to unfold? Like, was it everybody getting the same information, trying to do the same thing?
What all of them felt, and as I've refreshed my memory on a lot of these winemakers who came up at that time, and that would include Ken Wright and Patricia Green and many others, they were all proponents of making wine in the vineyards. In other words, if I can grow the best, most pristine fruit and look after the vines. And so most of these places were organic and following Wolf. Is it Steiner?
Rudolf Steiner.
Yeah. So they were really into getting as pure as they could the fruit, and then the wine would take care of itself. You cannot have like great wine unless you have great fruit that comes out of that soil.
They're kind of hippie guys,
They were
coming up from Davis, and the grapes they were using at the early stages were Pinot Noir clones coming from California. As they matured and got better at growing grapes, they spent time in Burgundy. They worked on getting a Dijon clone or Pomard, I forget which ones they were. But that takes a long time to import. So, it probably took multiple years to get those clones over here. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because the importation laws and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, they don't want insect, they want viruses and things.
But I mean, importantly, what Keith is saying is that for them, the holy grail of Pinot Noir is in Burgundy, right? And so visiting, and some, by the way, came here. There are several French families that have been involved in the Willamette Valley for at least 20 years now, who came from Burgundy. And they found that this, the growing conditions here were amazing. The community was amazing. It's not so, you know, insular, and they're very cooperative, this group. And it partly came, like what Keith said, you know, they were interested in building a community. Yeah,
so. Well, so, you know, one thing that interested me, I've always had this idea that the California wines, I don't know, that they had a certain attitude in their winemaking. And in Oregon, it seemed to be a different posture towards winemaking. It was more local, more in honor of the land, and less about, you know, trying to mimic the French outright. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I think the way they've built their community is a little bit different. And these communities have now grown with the advent of Pinot Noir, you know, in the 60s, and it really has proven to be a great spot to be growing Pinot Noir grapes. And we'll see, I think, in some of these wines today, very kind of Burgundian features and very un-California Pinot Noir features. You know, California Pinot Noir is lovely wine, but it's usually high in alcohol because the grapes get so ripe and it's so hot.
Yes.
That it's a struggle to sort of cool the fruit more than anything else.
Well, but, and in a way, it almost seems like it's a disservice to the grape. It gets sort of blown out.
You know, those wines are very good in their own way, but they're quite different from these. And I think,
Cooler. It's cooler in the Willamette Valley, though they're cooled areas in, like, along the Russian River Valley in California. It can be pretty cool and get winds coming off the Pacific Ocean and stuff. But it's cooler, generally cooler in the Willamette Valley, so the acidity is higher. Right. The grapes ripen and get enough sugar to have a.
But a lot of these wines today will taste your 12 and a half to 13 and a half. There's one I think that's over that, like 14.1 or something like that. But yeah, you're right. The acidity and the way that maritime air comes up into the valley is through what they call the Van Duzer corridor, and it's a pretty famous corridor. And so if you happen to have a winery, and I know there's at least one, if not two, that are in direct line to those breezes where things start cooling off in the afternoon and then cool dramatically overnight. And that's one of the things that's great about this area for winemaking is they have what is known as a very high diurnal change in temperature, which means during the day,
yes,
from the hottest to the coolest,
can be
a 35 degree Fahrenheit swing.
And doesn't that also mean a longer growing season?
It can, because the grapes stay cooler, so it takes them, like, they can be on the vine longer,
yes,
to continue to mature without having to endure heat stress. Or
and would worse. You say that generally that's an attribute of a grape that's going to be making a good wine?
I mean, I would. It's always the fingers crossed part in Burgundy. Sometimes it's like, if you hail and cool weather is, you know, do we have enough time for the grapes to maintain, you know, to get fully.
Yeah, it's always that
right
balance between time on the vine.
Yeah, Keith
and
knows a lot more.
Well, I mean, yeah, Pinot Noir is just a really tricky grape, and the clusters are tight. You know, you got to be careful about fungus and things in that. The management of the trellising system to make sure you've got plenty of air moving through to keep the grapes from rotting. California tends to be a bit drier, so it's a little less of a challenge.
There's a lot of vineyard management that goes on in the Willamette Valley. That's why winemakers, if they don't own their own vineyard, oftentimes they will own a specific number of rows in a vineyard, and that's where their sources, and they farm those. In many cases, their own people will come and make sure that they're thinned just the way they want it to be thinned from leaf so that they can help attain that ripeness.
In reading about some of these vineyards, there's an incredible emphasis on having a biodynamic approach to the cultivation of the grape and really honoring the sense of the land and wanting to be as environmentally appropriate as possible.
Yeah.
And that really became a standout for me as I was reading about these vineyards.
It's that community thing again.
Yes.
I know in one case, the last wine I think we're going to taste today, they have a 100-year plan for their land. Everything you can be doing to husband that land, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
The same
yeah.
crew has essentially worked that land. Their average life of even their vineyard workers is 10 years, and they had the same winemaker.
That says
since
a
their
lot,
exception.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
You know, he's been there since the very first vintage, and that was some 30 years ago.
Well, it's impressive reading about these individual winemakers in this part of the world. I had known nothing about the wines from the Willamette until I was in Seattle recently. I was doing an art fair out there, and an artist friend took me to this wonderful little tiny hole-in-the-wall restaurant called Single Shot, and that's where I tasted the wine that I brought for this tasting today. It's called Abbott
Claim.
Abbott Claim. it was an epiphany for me. All of a sudden, I became extremely interested in the Pinot Noirs from Willamette Valley.
I can't wait to taste that, actually.
Yeah, it's super good.
I've actually been to the top of that Abbot Klein vineyard. And that's the vineyard.
Abbot Klein is the vineyard.
Maybe from Mount Oregon. I don't know. It was an early claim, early land claim.
Oh, I see. Abbott, oh, interesting.
Abbott's claim.
The Abbots claimed it. Yeah.
I was just thinking a place called Single Shot. You might think it's a whiskey bar.
I know, and it's so endearing, and they have absolutely amazing food.
I was going to ask you about the food.
Oh, it's just so brilliant the way they do it. It's a lot of small plates, shared plates. So if you sit down at a table with six people, you can taste 14, 18 dishes, and every single one of them has a very distinctive take, and it's so fun to be there. And their wine list, accordingly, has, of course, some fantastic wines from Willamette and, you know, predominantly, I would say, West Coast wines, California.
Yeah. Thinking about that area and how hospitable it is, the valley itself, from Seattle's great, too, the valley itself, such a great food and wine scene. And,
yes.
And although we're talking
vibrant
about Pinot Noir today and a very, very important part of the Willamette Valley, they grow vast amounts, really, of Pinot Gris. Chardonnay is becoming way more important as things get a little warmer. And they're very successful with their Chardonnay. Yeah, it's pretty sought after. Kind of Burgundian take again, Keith, you know, just sort of not overly oaked. So it's not a big butter bomb kind of Chardonnay, but very interesting with food.
So, Larry, this is going to be so interesting for you because you really know the Burgundy wines so well, and to see how this translates to this sort of very, very different part of the world.
Yeah, I'm very curious. I don't know very much about these wines. Joe, you mentioned the Chardonnay a minute ago. Chardonnay typically likes the same climatic conditions as the Pinot Noir. So it doesn't surprise me. Is there a lot of Chardonnay in the Willamette Valley?
There's increasingly more.
I can give you
your statistics.
I have some statistics.
But I had a quick question for Keith. The recent extreme weather we've been having in the Northwest, has that been having an effect on... Has that been hitting the valley and changing things?
Most of the fires that have happened in the West have been sort of east of mountain ranges, and the Willamette is west, you know, between a range and the Pacific.
But it has been really hot in Portland, and I would have to think because it's not far from Portland to the Willamette Valley, at least the northern end.
Smoke could be the biggest issue.
If the winds are going the wrong way.
Yeah. Not just heat, you know, because it was 100 plus degrees there,
which is crazy.
Well, and so my friends out in Seattle, they were just describing their weather. When was that? In November. And they said it was a river of rain. It cut power for like a week. And imagine what that level of rainfall would have on a vineyard. So anyway, it's just there is climate shifts going on for sure. Before we taste the first wine, I just want to take a moment to remind everyone you're listening to What's My Wine? With some friends gathered around the table. Today we're tasting Pinot Noir. The people around the table today, Larry Burdick, Keith Zimmerman, Joe Canini, myself, Cynthia Reeves, What's My Wine? And this is WOOL-FM 91.5 in Bellows Falls. So can you describe the first label and the attributes of this first wine that we're tasting? Is this the youngest of the flight that we're looking at?
It is not the youngest. It's not the youngest, but generally speaking, in the valley, winemakers either have their own estate fruit, but they could be widely spread throughout the Willamette Valley. As long as they are in the valley, they can purchase fruit from others and make wine. Others make it site-specific wine, and we'll have several of those at the end, after the first two, I think, really. So the first two wines are what we'd call Willamette Valley cuvées. They would be blended from fruit either from their estate in different parts of their estate or, in fact, other wine growers as well.
Right, Joe. And that's so people understand the size of the valley is quite large. Actually, it's 150 miles by 60 miles in its widest part. The Willamette Valley AVA is that whole, however many square miles that is.
Yeah.
But within the AVA, there are sub-AVAs, which is American Viticultural Areas, of which there are 11 currently.
All of which became so because they had some distinct attributes of their wines, their terroir, whatever they had. So,
soil conditions, elevation.
It's not something that gets thrown around willy-nilly. I mean, you really have to kind of prove yourself as a group of wines to say we deserve this special designation.
And the AVA for the Willamette Valley, the broad one, was in 1983.
Yep, that was the first one.
1983, first one.
Do you think they're bringing the same sort of demanding criteria to these regions as they do in Europe?
Absolutely.
The AOCs and the AOPs?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think so too, yeah. I think they're very, very protective of them, actually, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, here I'm tasting just the first.
Which is from the Solina Winery, and it's their Grand Cuvée, and it is sourced from fruit throughout the Willamette Valley, and it's an older wine, 2012. So this would kind of be an entry-level, quite reasonably priced wine and sort of the pantheon of Pinot Noir price, quality, value.
But can you just clarify when you use the term Grand Cuvée, just so everybody's clear?
A cuvée is a selection, and so their Grand Cuvée is their best selection, and it can mean almost anything.
Yeah,
it's a very broad term.
Yeah, not like in France where you
it could be Joe's cuvée. It could be Joe's cuvée. You know, it could be.
It's a marketing thing.
Yeah,
that would be interesting.
It is a marketing thing. Yeah, it would be.
I like that.
Yeah. Anyway,
Vendetable, Willamette.
Vendetable, close to it, because it is 100% Pinot Noir. There's nothing else in this wine.
And Vendetable meaning the table wine.
The wine
that you would put out in a jug.
An everyday wine, very approachable from price points. The difference here is it's got some bottle age on it, and I happen to think this tastes very French. At 11 or 12 years old, I think possibly the fruit has gone down a tad. The acidity is pretty high.
What year is this, Joe?
2012. Which in the Valley was a very good growing year.
This question about age is very, very interesting. Some wines intended to be in the bottle for a long time. Some younger wines intended to be opened young, while the fruit is very, very fresh and vibrant.
I mean, honestly, I taste this, and this wine's not getting better. I think it's probably towards the end of its life. It's losing fruit.
Yeah, it doesn't have
just
the fruit.
Left with acidity. And so it would be good with some foods, for sure.
Yes,
need
yes.
some food.
Yes.
It's not a wine that anyone would around the table would consider off or bad. It's just not as good as it probably was 2 years after he put it in
well,
the bottle.
Do you know what was interesting? We did a tasting the other day of the Nebbiolo grape. And I kept a sample of each of the six bottles, and I had that yesterday with some guests, and we each tasted the wines, but we were also having cheese and pâté and some other. And it was just such a lovely pairing, and some of the wines that I had thought were weaker or lacked impact or structure during our tasting, at that second round, it was clear that they were, you know, they were created to go with food, and they came alive in a very, very different way.
And that grape, you know, that Nebbiolo grape is I guess notorious for showing itself after oxygen hits it. Another hard to grow grape.
It benefits from continuing to evolve, right?
Yeah.
It evolves with air.
In those cases, those were young wines. They're probably a bit tight, but they improved. I know the ones I retasted from that tasting all improved the next day. I don't think this one would necessarily improve with a couple of days.
I don't think so. I don't think there's enough
Keith,
there
you
to...
are not happy.
No.
I mean, this, you know, it's always fun to try wine. I mean, I like trying them
because whether
it's good, bad, or otherwise, I mean, or excellent, you know, it gives you, it's kind of like a B movie or something.
You
learn from it, and it helps you in the experience you have with another wine. So, to me,
of the run of quite a few of these that I had in the cellar and the least enjoyable. So
but it just remind everybody again, when you had the Windham Hill Inn, you became so familiar with the West Coast wines and this region in particular because the distributors were
really
so
lucky, yeah.
forthcoming, and they really spent a lot of time and educating you on these wines.
I have to give a little shout out to John Fagan, who's no longer on this earth, but he was the Pied Piper of West Coast wines. Both Washington State have some amazing wines, great growing conditions along the Columbia River Valley, and in particular the Willamette Valley. And so he was a Pied Piper. He was out there every year. He would invite people in the trade out there to go to what he called Pinot Noir boot camp, and it was phenomenal. And he taught me an awful lot. So I would thank him and his successors after him, because these distributors in some states are very protective of the wines they get to represent. And so they do a good job at promoting them as well, which means teaching people.
Yeah.
You know, that's really an exposing them. So,
but at some point it turned out that at the inn you had, I think, one of the broadest portfolios of Willamette Valley or Pinot Noirs.
Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley in particular. I drank the Kool-Aid, as it were, or the Pinot Noir, and I really enjoyed it and wanted to. And it also at the time, Most of these winemakers were still at their kind of the 15 to 20 year mark, and so the wines were priced also from the marketplace way less expensive than an equivalent, you know, French wine would be or something like that.
That's so changing now.
It's totally changing now. You know, being able to talk in the restaurant to people about what they would consider a mid-priced wine and see them get so much pleasure out of it.
We should go to number two, the wine number two.
And this is the one that you brought. Cloudline, can you describe it?
Cloudline is produced by the Drouin family. It's a private label, actually, for, I don't remember the distributor, but they make the wine, Drouin. It's a Willamette Valley, like the first wine we tasted, Selena. So these grapes come from somewhere in this 150 miles of tasting. Now, the difference is this is a 2023.
Young.
So the first wine we taste, which we said had lost its fruit character, if this wine doesn't have any fruit character, I would be really surprised. You know,
won't be surprised.
It's basically just been released 2023.
It's quite yummy, actually. Yeah.
You know, just came out. So we'll see how that
went. What a contrast. And that was the point, right? To have an old one that's a cuvée and a really recent one, and that my taste buds are really singing with excitement
right.
on the second
this
one as opposed to...
very jammy.
I love this word yummy when describing a wine.
Why not?
Joe, that was great.
It's a food, isn't it?
No, it has that sort of wonderful jam, jelly jam.
And it still
quality.
Has the acidity.
It's got a lot of fruit to go with it.
Yes, you know, it really gets closer into balance.
Yeah,
you know?
I think maybe black tea in there, mm-hmm. hiding in there, yeah. along with these
good.
Really
yeah.
bright fruits, yeah. Raspberries, strawberry coming through, but kind of in the back on the tongue. Again, it's always very subjective.
No, but I really like that black tea reference because that's sort of at the back of the mouth.
As soon as you said that, Keith,
exactly.
It's there.
Yes.
But I think this is so pleasurable, but it is the profile doesn't continue to develop after you've kind of thought about it for a second. So I would call this like a really great sipping. I mean, you could
probably sip
right along, no problem.
Yes.
This, and it's lovely.
Color
is
lovely.
Cloud Line.
Beautiful blue label.
2023.
Lovely.
Well, and what a distinction relative to the first wine. The first wine is such a different character altogether. And this one is very lively. But even though there is I'm going to say kind of a somber tone around the edges. It's not like some of these Sangioveses that are just so vibrant and dance in the glass. This has a little restraint to it as well. I don't know if that's the right way of describing it.
This may also get better. This might get better an hour from now.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, it's lovely.
We should come back to that one.
Yeah, this wine's only been we opened it
half an hour ago.
When you mentioned that some of these vines are only 20 years old, there are probably 40 to 60 foot long roots for the vineyards in France, right? I mean, they're digging way, way, way down into the soil. So the vines that are 20 years old, do they already have that highly developed root system? Are they digging that deep?
Yeah. In one of these vineyards, Ken Wright, who's the local pioneer in this area, and he's really into the soils, into the individual things. He owns several of his own vineyards. So he actually is part of this Pinot Noir boot camp, took a backhoe to a hillside near his vines and dug down. And he could, to show us all the different sedimentary soils, number one. But then he said, and look down here, and it was 25 feet below the grade, and there was the taproot of the vine.
I don't know the soil conditions there, really, if you run into bedrock or something, you know,
you do
how
run
struggling
into basalt,
it seems like
but
in
you
some
do.
Parts of that valley would have to run
We're
into
going to
something.
Taste something. Ribbon Ridge, I think, is coming up, and that's 18 inches of Jory marine sediments over basalt.
I read it about, you know, the soil in the Willamette, and they talked about the Missoula floods.
Yeah,
this is interesting.
Those big floods from near the Yellowstone Park and during the Ice Age. The ice dams gave way and these huge floods came down through the Columbia Valley. And
they reckoned hundreds of floods of sort of cataclysmic
epic proportions
came down from like 15,000 to 13,000 years ago. It's amazing to me what that's done because it's dragged all this stuff.
All the volcanic soil.
And don't forget, there was also volcanic soil in Oregon already because it's on the edge of the Ring of Fire. There's volcanic Mount St. Helens.
Mount St. Helens, Mount Hood is right
exactly.
there.
So you've got this volcanic soil and then all this other soil from places so far away that are overlaying either the basalt or the volcanic.
I mean, it's just great to understand history through wine. I mean, think about that geological history. We never would have thought about it the same way.
Yes.
We're actually tasting the results. Many thousands of years of climatic activity. Wow.
The history points out that through those floods, there were literally over 200 feet 200-foot depth of soil added to this landmass as a result of the flooding, which when you think about it, like we live on the banks of the Connecticut River, basically.
Yeah.
And we always refer to the floodplain. But think about what 200 feet of soil being deposited.
That would say that it would be easy for that taproot to go down.
It would make it easier, no doubt. It was kind of a loose soil structure that we saw.
No impediment,
it was like very
right.
interesting. Anyway, the Missoula floods and everything are like a fascinating part of the geology. The concept was very controversial for about a period of 80 years, but it's a few scientists spent their life sort of proving this is what happened, and they did it in amazing ways. And it's now the widely accepted theory, and the floods are now named after the man who dedicated his life to proving it.
The Willamette Valley region is a story of climate, soil, craft, and culture, and all these elements converge in a perfect storm for world-class Pinot Noir, which is a Pinot Noir that is competing head-to-head, in a way, with the Burgundian style of winemaking.
Just to recap, so the first one was a general appellation of the whole region?
Yes.
And then the second one was
the same.
So before we go into the tasting of the next wine, I'm just going to remind everyone that we're listening to WOOL FM 91.5 out of Bellows Falls, Vermont. The program is called What's My Wine with Larry Burdick, Joe Canini, Keith Zimmerman, and myself, Cynthia Reeves. And the subject for today's tasting is the Pinot Noir grape, specifically from the Willamette Valley in Oregon, which is a new region for both Larry and me. And Joe and Keith have much more extensive experience in tasting this. We've gone from sort of a broad-based wine from the region to perhaps this next tasting is going to be a little bit more specific. Is this where we get into the Abbott claim? Or
not quite. I think the next one is a wine from Patricia Green Cellars, her estate vineyard, and it's 100% Pinot Noir. And the year here,
2016.
And that coincided, sadly, with the last vintage Patty made. She was a very early pioneer who came up from UC Davis with Ken Wright and others, very successful at other people's wineries until 2000, when she and her husband Jim purchased a business and vines with it. She was a brilliant, brilliant winemaker. And this is in the Ribbon Ridge AVA, which is one of the highest elevations throughout the Willamette Valley. I've had several of these over the years, and I sort of cherish it because it was her last one. I don't know how it's showing at all.
Joe, just a question. The river has hills on both sides of it. Do I understand that correctly? Mountains or hills? And the river runs between them? Or you mentioned a high altitude for this wine, Joe?
It is, and it would be. And there were what I would call series of hills off of that basic spine that runs down that you're talking about. My understanding is most of the grapes are grown on the west side of that spine, and there are then hillocks to the west and south, and Ribbon Ridge would be one of the taller hillocks, and it would be further to the north in the Willamette AVA.
I have to say, this wine is, I find it to be beautifully balanced with lovely structure. Still such a wonderful, wonderful scent of fruit.
Really enjoying this wine. I'm with you.
It's sort of right there.
It's just, yeah. It's just so well, you know, all the parts are working really good for me.
Do you ask what the soil is, I think, or something? It's very thin on Ribbon Ridge. It's very thin, marine, sedimentary soil. Marine, so it's from the ocean.
Amazing.
You know, the other thing that happened in the Ice Age was that the oceans became much
covered
higher
everything.
Afterwards. When all those
yeah.
floods went somewhere, they went into the ocean. So it was all this raising of sea level. And so there are marine soils, shells, and whatnot at some of the tops of these hills.
Yeah,
which I find
also
amazing.
The collision of the
plates.
The plates
yes,
coming there.
Yes, tectonic plates.
All those lifting of the cascades and stuff.
The description here says that it's a particularly sandy, talky type of soil that is thin, low in clay, erosion prone, and highly, highly drained. It is underset by a seemingly endless subsoil of sandstone. Easily drained, so any water that hits this refreshes the vines and keeps going into the aquifer.
Where grapes are grown in Europe, there's limestone present.
Yeah.
So is there a corollary, do you think?
Limestone is usually would be more towards a marine sedimentary soil. I think sandstone is an underlying kind of harder rock.
Virtually everywhere you go and explore wines, the vines are struggling to pierce the stony soil and get their roots as deep as they need to be in order to capture the needed moisture.
It's amazing. They'll find a way.
Yeah, it's incredible.
They will find a way to do it.
There's one, I think that some of the oldest vines in Italy, the roots are about 100 feet. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Yeah.
So this vineyard was planted in 1984. It also had, besides Pinot Noir, originally planted and still growing Chardonnay, Riesling, Müller, Thurgau, and Gewürztraminer. So there's a good,
that's what's possible
in this wine growing area with the right elevation, the right cooling influences of the corridor.
But today, the amount of acreage planted in the Willamette Valley is just a little above 31,000 acres planted. Of that 31,000, 21,000 are planted to Pinot Noir.
So two-thirds are
to Pinot Noir, and the balance is the Chardonnay and the Gewürztraminer and the Müller Thurgau and Riesling and a few
others. That could change if the money changes, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like in California, they're planting more Sauvignon Blanc right now, which is more popular than the Chardonnay.
You mean as opposed to the Chardonnay?
Well, there's a lot of Chardonnay that, in my opinion, is a little weak,
flabby.
You know, whatever. But and this is part of it, right? Most of the Sauvignon Blancs I've ever tasted from California I've really enjoyed because they're smaller holdings, it's not
more
mass
artisanal,
produced as
more
much.
Care.
Yeah, there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, more
there
care.
You go. It's funny how that
That's
works.
Exactly right. Yes.
Anyway, this is a fun wine. What do you think, Larry?
The fruit, the acid, and then some salinity, they sort of seamlessly all mix together.
I love it.
It has a salinity, too.
It's a very, very good description.
Well, can I just take this opportunity to say that we are obligated to do a show on women vintners and to really celebrate how some of the, you know, even the great vineyards in Europe are being handed down not to the sons, but to the daughters.
I mean, we're almost doing that today. I mean, I don't think it matters, truthfully.
Well, of course.
Because, I mean, the cloud line... That's a woman.
Oh, is it
vendor.
Really? Oh, that's good.
It's a woman
oh,
vendor. Yeah. Patricia's a woman. I don't know the others, but I know those two of these five are
oh,
women.
Oh, see, that's really good to know.
I think so. Yeah. Selena is now owned by the granddaughter, whose name is Selena.
Selena. So three of these wines today.
Whoa,
so
that's
I mean,
excellent.
There are a lot of really great women and men making wine, and that's what
it's
we're
good
trying
talent.
To find.
Yeah.
Cynthia, no wonder these wines are so good. They were all made by women.
Thank you, Larry. That's so
No, I think Keith's
so
point
excellent.
Is absolutely right. It's a pretty... I think in the industry, like in all industries, I think women have been disadvantaged over time, but the great talent always rises to the top, and they're a very merit-based community. Again, a community that lifts all boats, too. They celebrate the female winemakers. They celebrate the male wine. They celebrate it all. They celebrate the grape.
I think certainly in this country, it maybe it's different in Europe. I don't know, but certainly here.
Well, and the other part of that story, though, is that this idea that winemaking is kind of a dreamy job, but it is so hands-on. It's so difficult. It's so time, nature, season.
Yeah, I mean, if you
weather driven.
If you want your hands to be nice and soft,
make bread.
Right. You know, make bread. Don't make wine because you're going to have cracked. You're going to be putting lanolin on your hands.
It's actually my vision: the winemaker's hands that are stained red at the tips, and the fingernails are cracked.
Oh no, it's worse than the whole thing.
Yeah, right. It's just amazing. And it's just hard work, and it's hard work all year round. Well, I think the next wine that we're going to try is the Abbot Claim. Is that right?
It is.
I'm actually super excited about this to see whether or not it sustains my level of interest that I had when I first encountered this a few months ago.
So the Abbot Claim is from Yamhill Carlton AVA. That's a sub AVA of the Willamette Valley, and it's a 2018.
For me, this is very interesting because I know of Abbot Claim, the vineyard, but when I was there in 2014, I don't know that the winery was in existence then. I think this could be a fairly new winery. It's an incredible fruit comes off of this.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Fruit, the fruit's coming
Cynthia,
off.
Cynthia, you've had this wine before then?
Yes. I tasted this just this past summer, actually, when I was out in Seattle, and found it to be so lovely that I actually, some days later during that same trip, I was hosting a small dinner party, and I took people to the single shot restaurant, and I ordered the same wine because both experiences were so great, the restaurant and the wine itself. And when I was doing research about the Abbot Claim, they have a holistic viticultural methodology. And so the emphasis is on organic and biodynamic and regenerative practices. So they grow cover crops and they practice what's called conservation tillage. They compost everything, and they prepare their own biodynamic preps. And one thing that really stood out to me was their description of making the wine. It begins with harvesting by hand at sunrise and immediately bringing the grapes to the winery where they're weighed and sorted and destemmed.
At their coolest.
That's pretty common. Is it really? That's not a surprise.
Yeah, trying to preserve fruit, fresh fruit.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It also then points back to this, the dream of winemaking and then the actual fact. You're in the vineyards, you know, at dawn.
You're in the vineyards before dawn.
Before dawn, right.
Full circle, full common. Making wine in the vineyards. That's what I'm talking about. It's about that quality of fruit and the dedication. And then they go on to ferment the juice in a tank gallery, they say. Kept cool by thick concrete walls. It would start in concrete and then go to stainless.
I don't know about your experience in the Burgundian area, Larry, but it doesn't taste like there's a lot of hard oak in this wine. I mean, it's not, you know, so I'm wondering if they're using some used 3 or 4 year old oak barrels or larger barrels so it doesn't have as much contact with the wood.
I know a lot of the great red wines from Burgundy were in concrete tanks and didn't see stainless steel. I know concrete was very common in Burgundy for a long time.
Yeah, I'm just curious because, you know, we're dealing with the same grape as the Burgundy wines from France, and that's something that you know quite a bit about, and you really love those wines. So I'm wondering how you're tasting this wine vis-a-vis the French Burgundy.
I haven't tasted anything here that makes me think, Burgundian. Having said that, which is not a criticism or plus or minus.
It does have a beautiful nose to it.
The
color is just so lovely. And I don't know what the alcohol content is on this one, but
12.5.
See, that's terrific, right?
That would be very, very, very rare
in Burgundy these days.
Mm-hmm. Except maybe a Pastoux Grand, which is a mix of Pinot Noir and Gamay.
So I'm going to ask Keith a fermentation question.
Here we go.
Well, no, that was a long time ago.
After fermentation, a combination of stainless steel and cement and wood, they then put it in barrel. And in barrel, by the spring, it has undergone malolactic fermentation. And I don't understand really what that is.
I read that word malolactic earlier today, and I thought,
secondary fermentation, but I'm not sure how
we have
it really
to get drilled
goes.
Down on that. Yeah.
But Joe, do you mean it just happens or someone did something to
it? I think it just happens. That's my understanding. But again, I wouldn't be asking that question if I really understood.
Well, I mean, usually it's something that the winemaker will do. Oftentimes, it's what the winemaker
provoked
will provoke.
Yeah. Oh, he will.
By it's a bacteria. Is it a little
yeast thing?
Bacteria.
Yeah, bacteria.
I don't know. You know, if it was an old barrel, perhaps
it would already
perhaps
happen.
It was there and it would just happen spontaneously.
Yeah, spontaneously. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Where I was working at the time, which was the Biltmore Estates in Asheville, North Carolina, we didn't do much malolactic fermentation. So we were just getting that vineyard started and the winery started. So it was just in the first year or two of the winemaking at the Biltmore Estate.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that that's the answer to a question and two questions, because they think it's a spontaneous start by their description, which means maybe that is they're using older barrels.
It's possible.
You know, if
but
they're
you can,
newer
all,
winery,
you can also inoculate.
Inoculate the barrels.
Can. The wine probably wasn't transferred to barrels till sometime in the early part of the new year after
like
the
January, February type of thing, the winter work.
They probably were letting it sit in the tanks for a bit longer, or the large vessels, before it would go into the barrels. But, you know, every winemaker, there's not a one way. You know, every winemaker has, depending on what they're tasting, is doing what they think they want to make that, how they want the wine to come out.
That's really a balanced, fresh-tasting wine, too. It's elegant.
It would be wonderful with food.
Nothing really standing out on its own, but the whole thing together is
great.
It's
a lovely, lovely background to a meal.
I taste some spice back, and very fruit up front, but maybe
almost
cinnamon.
Thank you.
Which
is really cool, and I think it's a little cool, the wine, maybe. And Pinot Noir, by the way, often benefits from just having a little bit of chill on the bottle.
Yeah,
correct.
But when this warms up, I think some of those spice notes might be
more pronounced. Yeah,
nice.
This reminds me of one of those northern Italian wines, like the...
Nebbiolo?
Like that Valtellinese wine from the north of Italy.
Yes.
There's more fruit in this to me than those.
But the weight of the wine is similar, I think.
Yes, the layer and that balance that you were just referring to, Larry. I think that's such a great word for this wine. Mm. There's just tremendous sense of balance.
Yeah. And Joe, nothing like what you brought us to taste last time when I say Northern Italian Valtellinese.
I love those Valtellino wines. Yeah.
I do too. We have to do
these
program
are wines
on those. Yeah.
For those of listening, these are wines that are in the north of Italy, up along the Swiss border.
Yes, tucked up by the Alps.
So they're
the
high
Dolomites.
Altitude, cool. Growing conditions.
And one of those areas, I think, the time almost forgot. The vineyards went through a long period of decay around World War II, and now they're really coming back again. Small
yes.
family holdings
Rightfully.
Really, you
yeah.
know, focused on small production and great quality. And I think they're coming
well. And wouldn't you say that overall there's sort of a trend towards that for people who are really enjoying wine and seriously interested in wine? There is this trend to seek out, I think, some of the more artisanal producers and the lesser known regions, which is one of the predicates actually of this exchange, is to try to find some of the regions that are a little bit less explored. But that also means that you can get wines of significant quality at great value. With that, I just want to remind those of you listening that this is a program, What's My Wine? And we're exploring the Pinot Noir and the Willamette Valley with Keith Zimmerman, Larry Burdick, Joe Canini, myself, Cynthia Reeves. And this is WOOL FM 91.5 in Bellows Falls. So we have one more wine in our flight of five wines today. And Keith, can you just recap what we've looked at and where we are in that tasting order?
Yeah, so the first wine we had is a winery called Solena. The grapes are from the broader Willamette Valley, which is 150 miles by 60. So it's a big area, a relatively big area. The second wine is called Cloudline. It's also from the Willamette Valley. The third is Patricia Green, and it's from a
Ribbon
sub,
Ridge.
Yeah, sub AVA within the Willamette Valley called Ribbon Ridge. It's 2016. The last wine we had was Abbott Claim, Yamhill Carlton AVA area within the Willamette. It's a 2018.
Do you know, for that last wine, there's this beautiful description. It says, the vine rows are hemmed in by stands of Oregon white oak and Douglas fir. The microclimate here is a rain shadow, protected by the Dundee Hills to the east, the Chehalem Mountains to the north, is that the right
Chilayim,
way?
Yeah,
Chehalem,
yes.
And the Coast Range to the west. So what is that? The microclimate here is a rain shadow. Isn't that one of the most beautiful phrases ever?
Yeah, and if you've been to some of these places, this fog does set in, you know, it just sort of moisture settles, especially in the fall. I was there in the fall, and it was quite beautiful, but to be at the top of the Abbeclaim Vineyard and be in the clear and see the fog underneath you.
Oh, interesting. Beautiful.
Cool.
Yeah. Layered valley, climate right valley, in front of you.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that happens quite a lot because these little hillocks, you know, that pop up here and there, and Abbeclaim is on one of them.
Very, very Japanese, the mountains emerging through the layers of mist. Rain shadow.
You know what I'm wondering? This is a question out of ignorance, because I haven't had a lot of American wines to drink. You know, when you drink, say, a Côte de Rhône or a Beaujolais or a Burgundy or a Bordeaux or whatever, you often recognize immediately a terroir and say, oh, that's a Bordeaux, or that's a Burgundy. With enough tasting and knowledge, will I get there? Well, I don't necessarily recognize a common trait yet, or a terroir that seems to be crying out a particular place. They're all great wines and seem to be well-made and clearly Pinot Noir, but what about that idea that will we recognize
Interesting, Larry.
A terroir with time, people like me who are just learning about them?
My opinion is you'll definitely recognize, like you do Bordeaux now because you've had enough Bordeaux, and Burgundy because you've had enough Burgundy. You might not be able to say, oh, that's a Montrachet versus, I mean, maybe you would with that if you had the chance to ever taste one, but it's hard. Equivalent of the sub-appellation is what we're talking about here. You might not get to that, but you get to the, well, this is a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir versus this is a California Pinot Noir. I think the distinctions are very, very pronounced.
But will it be a winemaking style that tells me that, or a climatic style, or will it really be a terroir message being delivered through the wine that will make me know that?
I think the terroir encompasses the first two things you talked about, so it's always going to be a terroir thing.
It does, but not all those things. I mean, I usually can say, oh, I'm drinking a California wine, or I'm drinking a northern West Coast wine. So often, knowing nothing about it, I can identify that much about what I'm tasting sometimes. So I guess I just have to keep drinking these wines until I'm familiar with
good
them.
Good plan. That's a good plan.
That's a good plan.
Yeah. See, like, to your question, though, I mean,
not too hard to do.
Was my question clear? I don't know.
No, I think it's a very good question.
Very clear
because I think to sort of use the parallel in a slightly different way, Bordeaux wines, if you go to Washington State, not too far away from where we're talking about, there are all these Bordeaux varietals grown. They blend them quite often in Bordeaux blends. But to my palate, I would not really confuse the two, knowing that they both taste sort of, oh, this looked like a Bordeaux blend, but one is way more lush and fruit-driven and higher in alcohol. That would be the Washington expression versus a Bordeaux. My personal opinion is that there's not that big of a gulf of a difference between Burgundian wines and these Pinot Noirs from the Willamette Valley, especially if you're staying in kind of the more moderate price points of Burgundy.
But, you know, at the same time, I've always had this pejorative attitude, say, about the California wines. I make an assumption that they're going to be too high alcohol content, too fruit forward, too juicy, and that's just not my style. That's not my palate. And so when I taste wines like that, I think, oh, California. And so that's why this particular tasting, for example, for me, is such a great education.
Joe, you were mentioning when drinking a Bordeaux blend in California, you don't usually confuse it with a wine from Bordeaux.
Force a comparison here in Burgundy. I would say that these wines in general are more fruit forward. Love the acidity in both wines. They are the same grape. They're grown the same parallel.
Yeah, I mean, actually, and I think when they first planted in the Willamette Valley, they were planting on the original rootstock. But there is phloxera in the Willamette now, so they're grafting on to phloxera-resistant rootstock, which is the same that they're doing in
almost everywhere
in the world. They haven't found anything that can control the phloxera. Right.
I guess, too, I have this prejudice that the soils in the European wines seem to contribute more distinctly to a wine than on the West Coast. And I'm going to find out I'm wrong, I suspect, as I learn more about the wines and drink more. But
that's interesting.
But it's a prejudice I've had up till now.
Well, I think that's valid, though, Larry, because, you know, in Europe, they've been growing grapes for wine for
thousands of years,
right?
Yes.
You know, going back to the country of Georgia, right, which is kind of where the first wines came from. And as we said, in Oregon, they planted the first Pinot Noir grapes in 1965, that is, not
1065.
So, I mean, it would make sense that the wine growers in Europe have figured out which varieties of grapes and clones work best in that area. And I think in America, we're still searching out what is going to be the best grapes for our area. The other thing that's a little bit different in California, so some legal things too that affected the style of wine there. In Europe, you can add sugar to, it's called chaptalization, you can add sugar to the must, the juice before it's fermented, to make sure the alcohol level is high enough for the wine to be stable. In California, that's also allowed, kind of. And here's the thing. The grape producers, grape growers in California, didn't want to allow cane sugar to be used to chaptalize the wines in California. So they had a law passed in California which said you had to use grape sugar. Well, grape sugar is a lot more expensive. And so the winemakers said, well, we're not going to pay for that grape sugar. We're just going to let the grapes get riper. So the sugar was higher. The acidity is lower. So there's a stylistic thing going on. There are reasons why the California style is the California style.
So it's not an absolute fair comparison if you were just take all those variables away.
That's interesting.
It's hard to take all those variables away.
And am I right that in Europe, specifically in France perhaps, you don't add sugar? It's just the merits of the grape.
Oh, no, you can add sugar.
You can add sugar. If you have a bad year, a cold year.
Oh, right.
In Burgundy, it happens more than
if it's a cold year and you can.
It happens often.
So you're allowed to chaptalize.
And they'll get to 12.5 and then they'll say, we're good to go.
That's it. That wine is stable now.
Yeah. So. And it was about stability in the wine, yeah.
I don't know if Keith remembers this. We once visited a Burgundy winemaker. He actually pulled out his sugar, a Demerara light brown sugar that he bragged about. This is the type of sugar I use when I add sugar.
For some reason, I would have cringed if I saw him dumping bags of that into a vat of juice. I know. I really would cringe.
But for him, it was just what you do whenever it's necessary.
Let's get on to the last one.
This is the Cristome.
This is the Cristome, and it's an amazing place that I've had the privilege to visit a couple different times, but it's in the Eola Amity Hills AVA, Willamette Valley. And Eola Amity Hills are so named because it's really an independent, go back to Larry's question earlier, independent volcanic chain in the middle of the Willamette Valley. So the river, there's mountains still to their east, the rivers around them, around those hills themselves. Because if you think about it, that great flood, it came down and eroded things all the way to the ocean, and the Eola Amity Hills were in the way as volcanic outcrops. So same family has owned this from the very beginning, 30 years. Paul Gary started this, same winemaker, Steve Dorner, who trained in Burgundy. So a lot of people look at Chris Tillman and say, boy, this was he's making the more Burgundian styles of wine in the valley. But he's a very sharing guy, too. Really, I got a chance to meet him and have a lunch with all his vineyard workers. Everything, great experience. But he is so dedicated to the people that work there. And the same people have worked there on average 10 years. But his vineyard managers, of which they have five, estate-owned vineyard, has been with them for 30 years since the very beginning.
That's so impressive.
They give them
it's such
total
hard work.
Props, and they deserve it. They make Pinot Noir, they make Chardonnay, they make Viognier. Everything is biodynamic, organic. And this is the place I talked about that had a 100-year plan for their land. They're real stewards of the land.
Which is the way one should approach the land by rights, don't you think?
It should be. The winemaker, Steve, is getting ready to hand over the reins, so he's had a woman with him for 2 or 3 years. They have not announced her as the new winemaker, and my guess is she will be. It's a pretty amazing place. Single vineyards are all named after family members, and we have Jesse in the bottle, 2012. We had another 2012 wine, which is the very first wine.
Which
we said, oh, that's, you know, that there's no fruit left in that one. That's not really the best. This is certainly not an entry-level wine, but all these wines are built to last. And I've had 2006s, I've had 2003s. I've yet to find one that's running out of gas. And this one's not running out of gas at 2012.
It's vibrant. It's lovely. It still has beautiful fruit. There's something, I don't know, I'm trying to capture this one taste around the edges of it. It's not necessarily a woody quality, twig-like something. It's interesting because it gives a definition to the shape of the wine in a way.
If someone asked us how we chose the order in which we tasted wines.
I try to start with the more entry-level wines and then maybe work your way up. And that's what we've done here. And I've also tried, if there's a chance to show old versus new and the same vintage, even if they're different parts of the Willamette Valley, I think that's a worthy comparison. So
definitely,
we're kind of trying to draw comparisons to how this grape behaves in this valley, how it might behave over time in the bottle too. And
I think sometimes, you know, we started with the 2012 Willamette Valley and then went to the 2023 Willamette Valley.
Big difference.
Oftentimes I would go the other way, but tonight that's not the way it worked. Joe had the Salina.
Second one would have been a real disappointment if we got it after the first, right? It would have been, and I kind of expected that. I pre-tasted. I'm like, this one's, but I think it's good to show it because I think that's,
there's always information
if
there.
If you're buying a straight Willamette Valley Cuvée in the wine store, you want to get one that's within 5 years of the release of the wine, I think.
Interesting,
and that's probably the point made.
I will say you learn as much from a bad wine as a good wine.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, though, it sounds like we're going from less complex to more complex.
That's the idea. Because oftentimes age is what provides that. So when we tasted the Nebbiolos, we had three different expressions of the Nebbiolo grape, but one was old, one was new, one was old, one was new, or I think we did it the other way around.
I mean, I just tried the first one we had, the Salena, right now. I can barely swallow it.
Exactly, yes. Once you've introduced fruit into
it. In fact, I have a spittoon here.
You're using that one?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean,
I think that lost fruit. In 5 minutes, it lost the little fruit it had.
This was not going to get better. I meant it by the minute.
You were right, Joe. You were right.
I think the styles of the wine are broadly the same. You know, they're using the same clones of the Pommard or Dijon clones, primarily from France. And the winemaking techniques are generally the same. It's a question, again, of where their vineyards are, how good their fruit is. It is the winemaking too.
Thing is too is that there's 700 wineries now in the Willamette Valley now. 700
up from 50 like 15, you know, 20 years ago.
Right. Oh, that's extraordinary.
There's so many wineries. So there's so many ideas about how these wines should be.
So many people wanting to do that really hard work.
Exactly. I think they can. That'll shake out too.
Yes.
Because it is really hard work.
It's hard work.
The most extreme version of that when I visited one time was I was told, you have to go here. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, this guy's making his wines in amphorae, the Greek clay amphorae. He's making the amphorae. So he started off as a potter kind of deal and
got
into the wine through there. And was making some really interesting wines.
Yeah, I'm sure. I haven't been out in so long. It's been many, many years since I've been in the Willamette Valley. But, you know, my guess is that there's still those, you could visit a winery and they're making the wine in the garage or some very humble facility. And you're talking with the winemaker who's also out in the vineyard. There's also those big estates where they hired some people to come up from California to manage the, right. the tasting rooms.
How big can it be? Yeah.
And it's a really different experience. Some, you know, and I'm not saying one's better than the other. You know,
one's more available than the other, typically because they're producing so much more wine in these small estates that are, you know, maybe 10,000 cases. It yeah. seems to be a lot for some of these small wineries.
So before we end our conversation, can we just go back and do a tasting between the last two wines, the Abbott Claim and the Cristome? Definitely out of all the wines that we tasted, for me, these are the ones that have the most complete structure, taste, that's all integrated. I think that was a word that was used in one of our last conversations. The wine is really integrated.
I mean, for me, they're actually the Abbott. The fruit is a little more pronounced in that wine to me.
Fruit's a little more black, you know, black cherry-ish yeah. kind of, you know.
And in the Cristome, I was picking up a little, and this is in a good way, a little bit of mushroom, a little bit of earthiness.
Oh, that's what I was searching for.
I think
yes,
that's what
thank
you're
you,
feeling
thank
back
you. Yeah,
a
that's
bit.
Perfect.
I didn't pick it up before, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. this last time I was
and
picking that up.
Red fruit for me.
Red fruit.
Mm-hmm. If I had a, and I agree with that, but a good synopsis of the differences, I think. If I had to guess, I would say the Abbott Claim had more clay in the soil, and the Cristome had more volcanic. Typically, the clay like amplifies the fruit, makes it a little softer, more velvety, and I get that in the first wine. And the volcanic, there's usually more acidity, and I get more acidity at the end of the Jesse Cristome
yes,
than I
definitely.
Do.
There's more acidity at the back end.
Mine, they're amazing wines. I'd put them up against anything really for pleasure.
I really like this Cristome a lot. But I'm trying to find the words to describe it. But what Keith and Joe mentioned already, I agree with. I might have to pour myself a little more to make more comments.
Yeah, no, it's only fair.
I like that you like this Cristome too, because there's a depth in the flavor there that's a little different than the Abbott Claim. The Abbott Claim is, it's kind of like a higher level kind of taste that's kind of weird. I don't even know how to describe that, but there's this depth of flavor in the Cristome, which is pretty amazing.
There's something very unique I'm tasting. I just got to put my finger on it so I can find...
In the Cristome.
Yeah, so yeah. I can find the adjective. It's something about... It's like three quarters of the way through the taste, something comes together and
exactly.
creates this flavor, and I'm just trying to put my finger on it.
Could it be candied orange peel, Larry?
I get a little bit of orange peel bergamot.
Yeah, bergamot.
Something mm-hmm, going mm-hmm, on there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those things are there, but there's...
There's something else.
It all comes together to create something else.
So we have been spending a fulsome hour with Larry Burdick, Keith Zimmerman, Joe Canini, myself, Cynthia Reeves. We've been exploring the Pinot Noir wines from the Willamette Valley in Oregon. This is WOOL FM 91.5 in Bellows Falls, Vermont. The music for What's My Wine was composed by Keith Zimmerman and arranged by T. Skoll, with Peter Stoley on accordion, Ashok Ajawal on bass, and Scott Shetler on clarinet, with Keith Zimmerman on guitar. This is a production of What's My Wine Radio out of Walpole, New Hampshire. Until the next wine, thank you for joining us.